Welcome to the 2014 Integrated Marketing Virtual Conference and Expo. I'm Thorne McGee, Editor-in-Chief of Target Marketing, and I'm pleased to welcome you to this first session of this year's conference. This morning's keynote is sponsored by Pardot, Salesforce.com company, and it will delve into the real question that matters to marketers. Why do your customers buy? Every marketing plan you make, every prospect you contact, and every lead you nurture hangs on that one question. Why do they buy? And more importantly, what's going to make them buy from you now? In order to understand that question better, today we are joined by the man who literally wrote the book on landing page optimization, the man who founded Conversion Conference, the man who says you have a lizard brain, but I'm sure he means that in the nicest possible way, Tim Ash, CEO of SiteTuners. Now, before I turn it over to Tim, I would just like to take a few minutes to go over some technical pointers about the virtual conference environment you're in today to make sure you can find everything you need and can make the most of today's experience. First, if you have any technical issues, troubleshoot by clicking on the widget at the bottom of the console marked with a question mark, or let us know via the question and answer box. You can also use the Q&A box to submit your questions to today's panelists. That's in all the sessions. We'll be addressing select questions at the end of each session, including this one. You can send them in at any time, and we'll ask you for them again right before we go into that Q&A time. Please make sure you turn off any pop-up blockers on your computer so you can utilize all the features on this console, and check out the Tips for Attendees widget below if you'd like to learn more about the console you're viewing on today. Finally, if you would like to view the session again later, don't forget that we'll be archiving the entire show today. We'll have the on-demand environment up and running for 3 months beginning on Monday, August 11th. Watch your email for more details. Also, just a final note, here in the Target Marketing offices, we're doing a little bit of remodeling. We've done our best to keep that out of the way of the sessions, but if you hear any banging during any of our sessions today, I apologize. We're doing our best to minimize any disruptions. And that's it for the Tech Talk. Without further ado, Tim, please go ahead.
Thanks so much, Thorne. Thanks, everyone, for joining us this morning or this afternoon or evening, wherever you may be. It is a virtual conference, after all. I would like to just do a quick introduction, and also Thorne mentioned the IMV14 hashtag. The general conversation about my topic, conversion rate optimization, is usually under the hashtag CRO, and my Twitter handle is below. So also, in addition to the questions, just tweet, let the world know you're there. Let me know what you're thinking of the session. I'll definitely review all of my whole tweet stream afterwards. Before I get started, I want to give you a little bit of background about my company so you can understand my perspective. I run an agency, I would say the premier one in the world, that's focused on conversion rate optimization. We're based in San Diego, but have clients all over. We work with large and small companies across all industries. So there's a pretty broad perspective. And we do three main things. We have three main practice areas. One is helping redesign websites and web experiences and mobile experiences for higher conversion. And these can be kind of complete teardown redesigns or quick facelifts of your current site. We, of course, also do landing page testing and test strategy development. And we have a growing practice in conversion management and helping our clients in any way we can with conversion rate improvement, knowledge transfer, training their internal teams and along our conversion maturity model and making them more mature, if you will. Time to grow up in the CRO business. All right, well, with that said, what I want to do is talk about that lizard brain that Thorne mentioned and I don't mean this in any kind of pejorative way, but the fact is you have three brains, not just one. And most of us think, you've heard that old saw about, you have the right brain and the left brain. One's logical and plans, and the other one is creative and, can't get to a meeting on time. Well, that's a very, very simplistic view of the brain. I'm going to show you the more detailed view. It looks a little something like this. So at the top, you have the big hemispheres. And you have the left and the right hemisphere, but all of that is just part of your brain called the cerebral cortex. That's your new brain. That's the one that is bigger in us than in just about any other animal proportionately. But inside of that, hidden is your kind of middle brain or your limbic system, and this part is the one that has to do with aversions and likes and dislikes and emotions and memories. All of that is really kind of interwoven and stuck in there. And below all that, and that's the part that keeps the lights on, It's the part that doesn't have to think. And I'll talk about each of these in a little more detail, but that's the one that keeps your heart beating at night. Now, you didn't have to think about every heartbeat unless you're a really advanced yogi practitioner or something like that. Most of us don't. It's the one that makes sure that if you get stuck under a car, the adrenaline system kicks in and helps you lift the car up and save your life. You know, it's the emergency response system, if you will. And we share that with just about every slithering lizard and dinosaur that used to walk the earth. So that's why it's called the lizard brain. So if we kind of look at it, though, what we focus on is typically the logical brain, like Mr. Spock here from Star Trek. And we think it's a high compliment when people are logical consistent and, weigh things and defer gratification and plan ahead. All of that seems very logical. And we hold this to be kind of a high aspiration. And this is where the bias kind of creeps in my mind of how we present information on the web and communicate with each other. So we as, people that don't want to be seen as random or irrational or mentally ill, we want to be consistent. Everything, our highest aspirations are around the positive connotations of a reasoning human being. And the thing with that is that you saw how big that was. Actually, I'm going to go back. And you saw how big the volume of this cerebral cortex is, how big it is compared to the rest of the brain. Those other parts are pretty teeny tiny. And the problem is, it's expensive to run, Mr. Spock. It's expensive to run your reasoning brain. In fact, your brain as a whole, that 3 pounds or so, burns about a quarter of your resting calories. So if you just sit around and don't move your muscles too much, a quarter of your calories just goes to keeping your brain going. So very expensive piece of equipment. And you don't even want to use most of it most of the time. And so this logical brain is not the only part here. So let's look at this kind of middle brain, the limbic system that I was talking about. Well, this is responsible for likes and dislikes. I hate boiled eggs, or ooh, I really like that movie, or wow, that's a pretty flower, or ooh, that was scary. All of that originates, all that emotional stuff originates in this midbrain, or it's processed in this midbrain. And so this is something also where memories are formed and they're intertwined. This is where all of our kind of sensory systems come together. The most vivid memories we form, the strongest impressions, have to do with basically how new something is, how shocking it is. I mean, I've never jumped out of an airplane, but I assume some of you have. And if you have, that experience was probably amazing. And if many of you probably want to do it again. And chances are if you did it for the 10th time, it would be pretty cool, but not amazing, because your scales have already been calibrated by what you've experienced in the past. And so this our memories are often formed in the presence of strong emotions. Why would you remember anything that's common and ordinary? Do you remember the way that you, put on your shirt this morning? No, because you've done it 10,000 times. There's nothing emotionally salient or interesting about that. And so basically your memory is there to help you deal with extreme things in your environment. Again, if I go down this path through the forest, there's a bear cave over there. Won't do that again. I'll take a different path. So again, we only remember things that are either fantastic or really awful, where we tend to. So it's all kind of intertwined in that emotional midbrain. But below all that is our lizard brain, our reptilian brain, our dinosaur brain, however you want to describe it. And this brain only reacts. It's there to help you survive. And it only cares about the things that are important for your survival. As I like to call it, the four Fs, feeding, fight, flight, the other survival responses, and fornication. We got to procreate the species, so let's find a mate. And so the reptilian brain is there. There's some key things that you need to understand about the reptilian brain, though. And One of them is that it doesn't ever change. It doesn't learn. Again, we like to think we learn from our mistakes, although most of us repeat them over and over. Well, the reason that that's the case is a lot of things are wired into these kind of subroutines, if you will, that originate in the lizard brain. So if you burn your hand on a hot stove, you don't have to go, perhaps I should pull my finger away because that smell of burning flesh is unpleasant. No, you're just going to pull it away. And if you touch a hot stove again for whatever reason in the future, you'll do the same thing. You'll pull it away. You're not going to think about it or change your response to those situations. You know, so the lizard brain does things automatically. It never learns. It does them the same way over and over because that's good enough for all of your ancestors to have survived and passed on the genes to you. Okay, it's automatic programs. You start with not a blank slate, you know, as a new baby, but with all of this hardwired programming in the reptilian brain. All right, now here's the scary part. Turns out about 95% of what you do all day long, every day, is pre-conscious. You're not even aware of it. And there's a lot of recent research in this area in neuromarketing, cognitive science in general. Malcolm Gladwell has a fantastic book called Blink about how a lot of this kind of subconscious operation of the brain. But think about it. You can't process billions of mental impressions a day and attend consciously to each one. There's got to be this filtering going on. And you don't think about driving the car to work every day. You know, you're probably thinking about what you're going to be doing that afternoon while driving a 3,000-pound missile that's capable of taking out other people on the freeway next to you. Think about that. Even those kind of things we do on autopilot largely. And that's, again, because our lower brains don't want to engage the thinking brain too much, and it's expensive machinery to operate. So the scariest thing to your brain is change. Okay? Change ahead. So you can think of your lower brains as being bouncers. Your cognitive, your cerebral cortex, your modern mind, if you will, your thinking mind, only gets engaged 5% of the time. The other 95% of the time, the bouncer says, I'm not interested. I'm going to keep you out. I'm going to keep that cognitive brain or that modern brain from being used at all. Okay? So if I had to use the logical brain to describe the functioning of your illogical mind, this is how I would draw the little chart. Okay, so basically, the first thing you go is it dangerous? If it is, you got to deal with it, period. And that's where your automatic reactions kick in. All right, then you take it to the next step, which is it new and interesting? Now, this is something that might perk kind of the interest of your emotional brain. Oh, is this an emotionally salient new experience? Wow, does this calibrate my scale? Does this peg the meter? Is this unusual? You know, it's like something feels wrong here, for example, would be kind of a quote-unquote gut response from your emotional brain, okay? So is it new and interesting? And if it's not, yeah, been there, done that, ignore it. So then the emotional brain kind of tanks it, makes it go away. And if it passes through those two, you get finally to the, okay, it's not dangerous, it's interesting, now I got to quote-unquote think about it, and that's when it gets kicked upstairs to your kind of to your logical mind. So I guess if many of you have seen this notion of the sales funnel before, well, I want to redraw the sales funnel for you from the neuromarketing standpoint. Here it is. This is your brain stem in control, your reptilian brain. The limbic system gets to filter some more stuff down, and your neocortex gets to pay attention to only a tiny, tiny little part. It's kept in the dark. You know, when I was an employee at a big company, they used to say, you know, we use the mushroom management principle here. And I go, well, what do you mean? My boss said, well, we keep them in the dark and feed them bullshit. And that's the mushroom management principle. So it's much the same way. Your lower brains keep your logical brain in the dark most of the time. And, you know, you might think you're aware of stuff, you might think you're making rational decisions, but in fact those decisions are already made preconsciously, and we can see this on real-time brain scans, and then you rationalized and made up a explanation for why you actually did that. All right, so hopefully you're seeing a completely different picture emerge. And again, just to sum up, your reptilian brain does the same things the same way. It never learns. It cares about basic survival, and it's the gatekeeper for the other two brains. But it's the dominant thing in your mind. So let's figure out how to appeal to these lower regions of your brain so that you guys can logically make more money. How about that? All right, that's what part two of my talk is about. Practical strategies, or as I like to subtitle it, how to make money off of this stuff. So I'm going to give you four strategies. By the way, there's a method to my madness because four is actually the limit of what you can keep in short-term memory, which is why, incidentally, phone numbers are chunked into groups of four or less. So here's strategy number one. Create a small number of clear choices. Now, I'm sure you'll have no problem figuring out who's the tallest man in the world and who's the shortest man in the world. These are both adult men. I think one's 8'11", the other one's a tad over 2 feet tall. They're full grown, and they met. Okay, at the time, they were the tallest and shortest man in the world, respectively. Well, if I asked you which one's the taller one, you go, duh, Tim, that's kind of obvious. And that's exactly the reaction I want. That's obvious. That's an easy choice for me to make. Okay. Unfortunately, we don't make it that easy. I'm going to use an e-commerce example to kind of counteract this, but let's say you're wanting to buy pens and you came to this website and I'm just showing the body of the page, and this is their homepage. Okay, go ahead, buy a pen. How would you know which pen to buy? What you see are tiny little images of pens. What do I make my choice based on? Which way they're leaning, how many are in each little picture, the colors that I can kind of see, the designs on the pens. There's not enough information there for me to make decisions because all of the choices seem really, really similar. They're going to present it differently. They could add a close-up of the front of the pen as well as the back. Is it a push pen? Is it a twist pen? Is it just a fixed pen? How easy is it to grip? Does it have the little thick rubber part so I can hold it easily? Those are the things that I would care about when choosing pens, not just teeny tiny little thumbnails. So they've really made it hard for me by having too much choice and making the choices visually very, very similar and hard to tell apart. So a lot of times what you wanted to do is have extreme differences. So many of you, in terms of your product selection, maybe pride yourself, if you're in e-commerce, again, for example, and say, well, we carry everything. We're kind of like the Amazon of, baby strollers. Okay, well, congratulations. So there you have 78 baby strollers that you expect me to look at, instead of saying, here's the super fancy one, here's the mid-range one, and here's the really cheap one if you just need a baby stroller on a budget. Great. That's going to be enough choice, and they're clear choices. So in a way, by putting very similar products, then I'm then forced to use my neocortex and my logical brain to compare and say, okay, well, this one looks like it's about 5% better than the other one when I consider all of the factors. Well, yeah, that's a lot of work. Don't make me think. That's the name and title of my friend's book. I think it's perfect for online marketing. Just keep that thought in mind. Don't make me think. Don't make me think with the logical mind. By the way, if any of you haven't read that book, by Steve Krug, you need to run out and get it. It was written many years ago, but it's still probably the best primer on basic web usability that I've seen. A very easy read, and he practices what he preaches. So Don't Make Me Think by Steve Krug. All right, well, let's move on. So to kind of sum up strategy number one, what you need to know is we actually get tired using the neocortex. It burns energy, and it's been shown that we make poorer decisions at the end of the day or after being made to do complicated kind of considered tasks. We actually get worse at our performance on other things. So what you should do is not overload me with information, not have similar choices, not have too much. And a lot of times that means kind of having a guided experience. A lot of times your knowledge of your business or the decision I need to make is a lot better than mine. That's why I'm coming to you in your website for your products or services. And so what you need to do is say, okay, well, let's take this hard decision and reduce it down to, say, a wizard. Not filtering, not, your typical search box, advanced search filtering, but rather ask me some simple questions. Oh, okay, sir, your baby stroller, do you have one kid or do you have two kids? Do you take this only on flat surfaces, or do you want to use it for, you know, as a jogging stroller for sports and activities? Probably if you walked into your store, you can ask me three or four questions and help guide me to my answer, even though there's a lot of choices. I don't want to look at all 78 of your stroller. Wizards, not filtering, is a very powerful tactic. So think about what knowledge you have about your business and how you can embed that into your website as a process where you're asking a few simple questions with limited choices. All right, let's move on to strategy number two, using a big anchor. Now, I don't literally mean an anchor like this, but let me ask you a question. Let's say you're interested in buying a hosting plan. Let's take a look at this. This is an actual website. You have three choices of hosting plans, large company, client of ours, or remain unnamed. So you have, and the way they present them is a side-by-side choice. So there's one for $250, there's one for $4, and there's one for $6. Now, you read them in that order, probably because you read from left to right and, you know, in English-speaking settings. So you're probably thinking, well, $250, $4, $6. And I bet I can tell it, when you're considering the $6 plan, you go, wow, that better be a lot better because I can get this other one for $250. So they set the expectation by having me anchor on the first number I saw. I anchored on the $250 because that was the first thing that hit my experience. And then I saw a higher one, and then I saw a yet higher one. So there's this kind of resistance in me already. It's like walking uphill. Those other things are effort. They better be good because they cost more money. I'm already fixated on my $250 plan. I don't even know what's in it yet, but I like it. It's $250. I don't want to pay $4, and I don't want to pay $6. Okay, now they're for completely different audiences, it turns out. One is for consumers, the other one's for business websites, but you really wouldn't know that by looking at them. You're just, they put these giant numbers up in that order. Now, let's think about, I don't know if you've ever been to a nice fancy restaurant with the wine list, but if they have, you know, half a brain, most of them will have their wines in a particular order. And the order isn't, you know, best to worst. They're all somewhat organized by region, you know, Burgundy wines versus Napa wines, whatever. But within each one, they usually put them in decreasing price order. They put the expensive ones first. Have you ever been to dinner and seen that $500 bottle of wine at the top of the list? And you're out at a business dinner, I've done this, and I go, wow, that's crazy. Oh, look, there's a nice Rodney Strong for only $75, is, you know, a couple of places down on the list. I'll get that one. I won't seem like a cheapskate. Now, the fact that you could go to Costco and buy that same bottle of wine for $25 instead of $75 is not something that you're thinking of. What you're thinking, you've been scaled to the first thing you saw, which was a $500 bottle of wine. So, for example, we have our a kind of eye-tracking prediction software called Attention Wizard, and on our site, we have three plans. But notice the pricing. We have the gold, silver, and bronze, and they cost $200, $100, and $27 respectively. So if I calibrate you to the $200 plan, and then you see a $100 plan, then you see a $27 plan, you're going to, by the time you get to the $27, you're going, eh, that's pennies compared to $200. It is, because we've anchored you on the $200. Now, again, that plan is for larger enterprises. We don't expect you to do it anyway, but what we're doing is reinforcing for the 95% of people that get the bronze plan that it's a good relative value. Okay. So this is a very powerful technique, and so here's some ways you can take advantage of it. Okay, we're going to anchor on the first thing we see, no matter what. So what you can do is add intentionally a high-end item, which you don't expect to sell well, above your current high-end item. Show things in decreasing price order, and then the sales of your reasonable compromise will increase. And a lot of times you can put irrational anchors in what I call the lobby. Before the actual decision, you can make something that just in a completely unrelated way calibrates me to a large number. So if you say we have over 100,000 customers, and then on the next page you show me something that's 1995, well, the 100,000 written out in large numerals on the previous page is already anchoring my experience, even though the number of customers and the price of your product have nothing to do with each other. So if you can pre-prime me even before I get to the decision by anchoring me on something that's bigger than what you expect me to do, that's often very helpful. All right, let's move on to strategy number three, and that is be in my cultural tribe. Now, again, this has to do with your emotional brain and the affinities we all form. So you can think that we're all members of cultural tribes. Some are voluntary, some are involuntary, and we don't get to choose them. If you're an orphan or you're born with a certain skin or eye color, those are not choices you make. But other things are voluntary, whether to, you know, cut my hair in a mohawk or shave all my head off like I do. Those are voluntary decisions, and the BMW tribalists are very loyal to their ultimate driving machines, and the Honda people are like, why would I overpay for that, you know, that Teutonic piece of crap, right? So we each have our perspective, and we look at it from the perspective of our visitors. And so the thing to understand here is that you have to speak to your audience. So here's an example, the oatmeal. Some of you may read this. It's a funny website, and it's kind of aimed at, you know, nerds that are smart, and, you know, but they can be irreverent and laugh at themselves. So their latest book here on their cover at this time was a new book, How to Tell If Your Cat is Plotting to Kill You. It's very cute. You can see their editorial style. You can see the graphics they use. Okay, but that's a very different audience than this. Gears of War, Judgment. Watch the extended teaser on Facebook. And the reason I pull this out is a very dark, dystopian, violent kind of image they're doing. And guess what? There's very little overlap between the 15-year-old boys they're trying to attract with this and the readers of the oatmeal, I would venture to guess. Now, perhaps I'm wrong, and there's some of you in the audience that like both Gears of War and the oatmeal, but I kind of doubt it. So I guess the point here is that in terms of being in my tribe, what you need to know is we are tribal. You can think of yourself as an overlay of allegiances, whether it's your college football team, whether it's your hobbies, whether it's how you dress, what part of town you live in, the car you drive. All of those define us, okay? And the point is we care about our peer group. We care about the opinions of other people that are similar to us, okay? So how you can take advantage of this as an online marketer is to look the part. Through your colors, through your design, through your editorial tone, through the amount of information and how you present it, you have to say, okay, this resonates for my target audience. They should feel at home here, okay? And again, jokey editorial tone versus drop-dead serious, you know, that depends on the part you're trying to look. But here's the key thing. Don't worry about alienating outsiders. Just like the election a few years ago was decided on a very thin, tiny margin. It was actually decided by people in southern Ohio, as it turns out. And so if you saw those annoying political ads, and you go, well, you know, I'm in California, that's way too conservative for me, or I'm in Alabama, and that's way too liberal. Again, I'm just picking those out of the air, but that's the reputations, right? We're not the ones they're aiming it at. We're only trying to swing the undecided voters in Ohio with that information, with those ads, the ones that hadn't made up their mind yet. They don't care about the loyalists on both sides of both parties. And in much the same way, the tighter you can get your messaging, the more you can seem like you're in my cultural tribe, the better. And it's okay to alienate outsiders. You know, it's not for them. It doesn't matter if it resonates for them, and if you, as a marketer, dilute your message by doing generic marketing speak and making everything mamby-pamby, you're not going to hit your target audience, and that's who you're trying to affect. All right, I have one final strategy for you, and that is understanding the power of visuals. And this is something that is often underrated, but let me just give you again a little dive back into the biology. So that you can appreciate how powerful vision is. Most of your brain, I mean that literally, over half of your brain is devoted to processing visual information of one type or another. Okay, we're highly visual dominant. Can you see that? Can you picture it? Do you have the vision? All of those words, think about it, when we describe things, are a way to transmit visual information into somebody else's mind because there's such a visual bias. The vision thing, you know, I don't see myself doing that. Think about even the language that we use for those kinds of things, right? Moving on, we have two types of vision in our brain, you know, seventh grade biology, rods and cones. One's kind of see fine detail in a very range of vision, narrow range of vision in their visual field, about 2%. And then we have really wide, 220 degree motion detection. So the world to us is actually if we don't jitter our eyeball around, looks a little something like this. It's gray, it's monochrome, and it's fuzzy in detail. And then we start moving our eye around through these involuntary movements called saccades, and we focus on a spot. Then we jerk our eye over to somewhere else, and, oh, that's interesting. And then we move it around, and these are undetectable. These are involuntary eye movements, these saccades. And you kind of focus on different points in your visual field. But here's the thing, folks. We think we're seeing a high-definition picture of everything. We're not. Turns out your brain fills in the gaps, and you only end up seeing about 2 to 3% of a typical field of view. So you're making assumptions about everything else in the room or out the window or on your hike or on your even on your computer screen. You're not actually seeing it. Try taking a roll of paper towel tube and looking through that, and imagine your whole world is where you decide to aim that thing. You don't see the whole view. You just see that high-definition stuff in the middle, and you move that around to try to get a picture of reality, as it were. So that's another thing to understand, is kind of these visual biases. All right, let's go through something real quick. This is Best Buy, and I'm just going to ask you, what do these guys sell? Now, most of you are probably thinking flat screen TVs. Okay, now, what do they sell? Well, I don't know, vacuum cleaners, perhaps. Now, if I ask you now, what do they sell? Oh, you're probably going to tell me it's appliances. And no, wait, well, now what do they sell? Well, looks like they sell Xboxes and laptops. No, wait, now what do they sell? Oh, the shame of not having a smartphone. All right, well, let me ask you something. You guys are following along. You're all pretty bright folks. I know this is not high interactive here in the virtual conference, but let me ask you, what was behind the question mark on this page on the previous screens that I showed you? I bet you're going to have a hard time coming up with it. And the fact is, it was the Olympus Tough digital camera, which, by the way, are great. They're waterproof. You can drop them in the sand. You can go skiing with them. And by the way, that was there on the previous slide. And on the previous slide. And that bottom part of the page, folks, did not change. It was there on every frame I showed you. But we had that banner ad, that slider at the top of the page that would reset our attention think about it this way. If you use motion on your page, I have to pay attention to it because that's coming out of my primitive survival brain, and I have to make sure that if something's changing in my visual field, I see whether that's going to be something that will impact my, survival prospects. If something is rapidly moving in my visual field, I can't not look. Okay, so use visuals sparingly, especially if they're videos. Think of it, there's this kind of hierarchy of video, high-impact graphics, and text, unless you make 96-point giant headline is in red, text is normally less important. So you think of it as a hierarchy, and motion will override images. Images will override text in most situations. So you have to be very careful with these sliders, and I don't care if it fades, dissolves, burps, or whatever to get to the next slide. The point is, using these carousels and sliders is very dangerous. It's like dropping a hand grenade into the middle of your page because nothing else will withstand the blast around it. So it makes it very hard to visually prioritize or to pay attention to even high-impact graphics because a photorealistic image of a camera is a pretty clear, understandable physical object from our brain's perspective. All right. Now, the emotional brain also has a bias towards faces. We have a special part of our brain that will kind of recognize faces, and on this page you're not reading text, so even without the video being there, emotion, you're looking at bald guy and smiling guy and white haired guy. But do you know what this company does? No, because you're looking at all that. So one thing you can do is deliberately use graphics on our own website here. My head is used to draw attention as a universal to the kind of generic backup put us to work button. But in the body of the page where the main focus is, we're using photorealistic graphic, in this case of this supercar, to make you look down at the button and focus your attention. That's a very deliberate use of the graphic. And the same way, how you use video is very important, not whether you use video. So on our old Conversion Conference website, we had a little video viewer, and this is how we recommend you do it, because we've been conditioned by Facebook to have these little thumbnail viewers. And then when you pop them up, then you can see Steve's crude keynote and, you know, pop up a video player in nice high resolution mode. So don't embed your video viewers in your page or have them autoplay or anything like that. Unless you're deliberately trying to control attention, in which case you can have even walk-on video spokespeople. That's sometimes very effective. So have somebody walk off the screen, say a short 5-10 second script, point you to a longer video at the top that they want you to watch, and get this kind of 1-2 engagement. That's going to be very powerful. And how you cue things off is very important. So how you indicate a video player, ironically, this is Camtasia, which has video editing software, but the button that they want you to play to push to play a video is that dull gray little thing. It doesn't even look like a button. It doesn't look like a video player, that's for sure. So I guess what I'm saying is be very careful with graphics as well, how you indicate video, where you draw visual emphasis, how you use faces. And you know, there's lots of ways that we can predict eye tracking. You can use eye tracking technology itself. You can use mouse movement recording, or you can use software algorithms. And of course, mouse tracking is very powerful. It's a lot less expensive than eye tracking. So that's kind of the poor man's eye tracking. And we've developed software, as I mentioned, called Attention Wizard, which actually will predict hotspots of attention in a graphic, in a static graphic. So you can upload even a mock-up of your page if it's not live and see where we predict attention will go. So in this example, no surprise, it goes to the people's faces. That's where we predict the hotspots will be in high contrast areas of the page. So that was a whirlwind tour. I want to leave a little time for Q&A, so I want to leave you with my fourth strategy. Understand visual graphics. The process is very quick and powerful, so our attention will be drawn to strong visuals. Use pictures of people carefully only to support your calls to action. Don't decorate. Don't put stock photography in. Don't use unnecessary motion or video. And test how you deploy it, because the how is more important than the whether to have it or not. So here's a recap of the strategies. Create a small number of clear choices. Use a big anchor. Be in my cultural tribe. And understand the power of visuals. Now, as Thorne mentioned early on, I wrote the book on landing page optimization. I also run, this is our fifth year now, the Conversion Conference Series. It's worldwide. And in the U.S., we're moving to a once-a-year big mega show format. The next one's going to be in May in Las Vegas. So I encourage you to check it out. I think the early bird rates are still in effect for a little while. So just go to conversionconference.com. We're going to have 4 tracks over 2 days. You're going to learn a lot. I'm drinking from the fire hose. I'm very easy to get a hold of. Please reach out to me on social media. I'd love to connect. And again, looking forward to your questions.
All right, Tim, thank you very much. And as Tim said, we do have some time here for Q&A. We have a couple questions queued up, but if you have anything you'd like to ask, please use the question and answer box down there to ask it. Also, you know, I didn't mention it in the beginning, but all day we're going to be keeping our eye out on the Target Marketing Twitter account for people tweeting tips and quotes and slides from the show. So if you tweet something from the keynote or any other session, you know, use our hashtag IMV14, and we'll try to pick it up and retweet it to our followers and give you a little extra exposure. Now, to start off with the first question, Tim, and I think this is one that, I think a lot of listeners had this question, and you touched on it a little bit at the end, but the kinds of tracking analysis that you're talking about when you're looking at the visuals on the page and evaluating those and how you use those, you know, one of the listeners asked, you know, that's not exactly available on Google Analytics. Yeah, can you go into more detail about what kinds of tools you use?
Okay, so let me... Yeah, perfect. Let me go back and just talk about the 3 options that you really have. And the first is eye tracking hardware. So you can set up someone with an eyepiece headset. Some of them use stereo cameras built into a computer monitor you're watching, so it's not invasive. But basically recording every minute thing that somebody does, where they fixate with their eyes, super high speed stuff. The problem with this is it's expensive, and you have to in real time watch these videos and recordings to figure out what to do with all of this rich information. So it's great, it's the gold standard, okay? But the thing that most people use is mouse movement recording, which looks a little more like this. You've probably seen these mouse movement heat maps. So based on where people move their mice on the screen, a few people consistently use them as a pointer. So you can tell where they're kind of looking or what they're paying attention to by these mouse movement heat maps. And that's about 85% correlated with eye tracking. But the problem with that is you still need to be talking about a live page on a live site and run enough people through it to get those numbers on, you know, those average numbers for where they, where they're looking. Our software, Attention Wizard, actually predicts, based on what we know about the brain and visual processing, what we pay attention to. So contrast, colors, closure of shapes, of course motion, but these are for static images, skin texture, faces, and that's how we kind of create a heat map. So this, the advantage of this is you get your feedback instantly. It could be your design for a new page. No real people are involved in this process. You just upload an image and you get one back. That's a heat map. And we use it to fine-tune visual attention. The main point here is that you'll have gross kind of egregious violations of this, and you want to get rid of all the visual distractions. And this is just kind of more proof that people are not looking at your call to action. They're looking at the stock photo you used, or what I call business porn.
Just to clarify, going back one step, when you talked about the mouse tracking, now that's not something that is, you can't get mouse tracking from your site.
Yes, you can. This is built into your in-page web analytics. So software like Kissmetrics, like ClickTail, these are that's built into them. So you're recording actually their interactions with your page. How much time do they spend hovering over the button before pushing it? Where they're moving their cursor? That kind of stuff.
Very interesting. All right, I want to get on to the second question here, which actually, and I'm actually glad this one got asked because I was wondering it myself. At one point, you had mentioned that, you know, for instance, that Facebook has conditioned everyone to expect that little image thumbnail, the thumbnail for a video, to be kind of in that place, in that shape, in that style. And one of the listeners and me as well is wondering how powerful and frequently used are sites like LinkedIn, Facebook, and Amazon in setting those kinds of expectations. What's the likelihood of their influencing how your customers are looking at their site? And, you know, does that evolve? How quickly does that evolve?
Yes, that's a great question. One of my professors at UC San Diego was Don Norman, who's literally wrote the book on user-centered design back in the early 80s. And, you know, one of the things he talked about was convention, the power of convention. Now, it's not the same as walking down from Mount Sinai with something written on stone tablets, but conventions are something that groups of people agree to do a certain way. For example, when you visit a website, where do you expect the company logo to be? In the upper left, right? So that's a strong convention, and you'd have to, you know, you don't want to piss into the wind and redefine that and put the company logo in the lower right. So a lot of people have agreed that they're going to use it that way, just this, much the same way when we have forms and buttons and navigation bars and things like that. Sometimes new things come in, so on mobile phones, and there's you know, vertical scrolling is a much stronger convention. That didn't used to be the case before mobile phones. So it's kind of their evolving standards, but you have to think about where do people spend most of their time and how do their context or expectations get set? Where do they get these, the idea for these conventions in the first place? So sites like Amazon, doesn't mean you should ape them, or LinkedIn or Facebook, where you spend a lot of time, are definitely going to influence your browsing behavior, and it will evolve slowly over time.
Now, have you seen any evolution recently in that? For instance, with these continuous scroll sites, and like you said, the single scroll sites that are coming out, is that
the
expectation?
Personally, I think that for the web, a single scroll, a single page, infinitely scrolling kind of site is a really horrible idea, because on the web, the whole paradigm is hyperlinking and clicking on things. But if you have fat fingers and you're on a tablet and a phone, about the only thing you can do is vertical scrolling. So it's very appropriate for that. But this whole notion that responsive design is really one size fits all and it's just a resized version of your one-page website, I think that's a horrid idea.
Interesting. That almost sounds like a conversation for another session.
Absolutely.
About responsive design. Hey, one more question. We've only got about 90 seconds left here, but one of our listeners is asking, you know, when you're talking a lot about the impact of vision, how much do you think about people who might have impaired vision? For instance, specifically dealing with how do you think about people with colorblindness coming to your site? Does that enter into it at all?
Colorblindness is a relatively small percentage of the population. It does affect men more than women, is my understanding. I would say, you know, the hearing impaired are actually a very important class, and you need to make sure that when they do text to speech, or rather speech to text in videos, that kind of technology is now available.
Yeah.
The ability to transcribe and put text into your site as opposed to into images, which can't be decoded. things like that. There's definitely some kind of people with disabilities. You need to take that into account, especially if that's important for your audience. People with hearing aids, you'd expect that they're on a hearing aid site that you make accommodations for text as opposed to audio.
Right. So part of it has to do with what you expect your audience to be.
Exactly.
I think that's about all the time we have for our questions today. On behalf of Target Marketing and Printing Impressions Magazines, as well as our sponsor, Pardot, I want to thank you all again for attending this keynote session today. If you're interested in discussing anything you heard during the presentation, we encourage you to visit the Networking Lounge to chat live with our other session attendees. Please also visit the info booth and fill out our show survey to let us know if you had a good experience today or the kinds of things we can do to make it better for you in the future. Remember, if you miss anything today, the entire virtual show will be archived. The on-demand environment will be available for 3 months starting on Monday. Have a great day. Enjoy the rest of the show, and I hope to see you around. Thank you.